What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world, not forgetting current events that occur, plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah, Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
And we welcome you in a legal face-off on WGN Plus, the last episode of the 2016 calendar year with Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. My name is Sam Panionovic. You know the deal, WGN Plus, WGNplus.com. So many topics today. We will talk about a story that lawyers are only billing a fraction of their time. We'll talk about healing to action and a loaded grab bag with another Chicago alderman, surprise, surprise, getting indicted. But we start now with the newly inducted president of the Illinois State Bar Association, Vincent F. Cornelius, who went in on June 17th of 2016. So it's been almost 6 months to the date as we welcome him now to WGN. Hello, good morning.
Morning. Glad to be here. I appreciate this opportunity.
Hey, thanks for joining us, Vince. You're a fellow alum from Northern Illinois University College of Law. You're on the board of visitors with me, so you and I know each other well. You've got a great, long and distinguished career, having worked as an assistant state's attorney in DuPage County before opening your own practice in Joliet and Wheaton. And as Sam said, you are now the president of the 32,000-member Illinois State Bar Association. So let's start by having you tell us what is your agenda as president. What do you want to accomplish in your term as president?
Well, I've been really focused on a couple of very, very important things. And the first of which has been to address issues of new lawyers and young lawyers and law schools and law students and law school deans, because they really are the future of our profession. And generally speaking, the legal profession is slow to change. that's just how we are. And we can't afford to be that way anymore, because newer, younger lawyers who have a different mindset, a different approach, who are accustomed to doing things a very different way, have become a significant group in the practice of law.
So what's the number one challenge, you think, for young attorneys? Coming out of law school today, I think they're a little bit different than when you and I came out way back in the 90s. I think the attorneys that I am hiring, a little bit different mindset, certainly less jobs there than maybe today than there were back, a few years ago or a few decades ago. So what's the number one challenge, you think, as a young attorney who is either coming out of law school or just starting their practice?
Well, I suppose it's all a matter of perspective. I think young lawyers who are coming out today will tell you that their student loan debt is extremely high. Job availability is less than what they anticipated, less than what they expected. I think the other perspective, that from the lawyers who would hire them, would like to see them more of what they call practice ready and ready to hit the ground running. And those are the real challenges that are out there now. And at the end of the day, there is, as in the rest of the world, a bit of a generational divide, and the established traditional lawyer has his and her perspective, and so do the newer, younger lawyers.
So we've talked on this show before about, with many law school deans, for example, about whether there's too many lawyers. There's certainly not as many jobs available today as there were some years ago, yet there's still, lots of people graduating from law school. The numbers are down, but there's still a huge number entering the marketplace every year. The question to you is, from your perspective, is there too many lawyers? Is there enough jobs to sustain the amount of people entering the workforce?
I don't think there are too many lawyers. And the reason I don't think there are too many lawyers is that there is this tremendous unmet need for lawyers out there, this huge underserved population, and the rural parts of our nation are suffering greatly for doctors and lawyers. And that is the dilemma. It probably has to do more with where lawyers are located than how many lawyers there are.
So how do you get, the next question would be, how do you get people to those areas? You know, everyone wants to practice in the big city. We see a lot of corporations like McDonald's moving from the suburbs of Chicago, which, you know, aren't very rural, but yet, you know, even the suburbs of Chicago don't seem to be enough for millennials and for young people. They want to live in the city. So how do you get people who are entering the profession to serve those underdeveloped areas?
Well, that is the question of the day. And, you know, the world is a more global world now than it ever was before. And so we have to begin to develop other ways to access this legal expertise than sometimes just necessarily being there. But I like and have thought much about how we connect an aging population of lawyers in these areas to newer, younger lawyers who are ready to start and develop their own practices. And so I think there's a fantastic opportunity here for an older lawyer who is ready to retire, to leave the practice, who has this practice, who still has clients, and wants to ensure that his community is still served and wants to ensure that her clients are still taken care of. And so when we can create a transitional phase with a new lawyer who would come in kind of in one sense, although a qualified lawyer, kind of an understudy who is learning the practice, who is learning the community, who is learning the legal community, and becoming a trusted member of the community. I think when we can begin to do that, we can begin at least to nick away at what is a huge problem. There's no real answer to how we can persuade someone who does not want to live in a quieter, more rural area to go there.
And Vincent, as an established attorney, are there opportunities to help reach out with younger attorneys? Myself, I'm a small law firm, five attorneys. Is there an opportunity through the ISBA for us to help out with, let's say, a new, you know, younger attorney wants to be a solo? And we have an office, too, in Joliet. So, you know, that's more of an area that I would probably see that prime opportunity.
Yeah, we do. We have some fantastic mentoring opportunities that are available for young lawyers. And the things that I've been talking about, we do kind of, we have some of those things in place that tend to fit the lawyer's need who is trying to transition. And, you know, we have a wonderful solo and small firm conference. We've got a number of things that help lawyers to transition into the practice of law and to transition into their own practice. And we start in the law schools, and I've spent a lot of time in the law schools this year. In fact, at my alma mater, I went there to speak at their orientation. I was at the University of Illinois as a Southern Illinois university. I spent some time at Northwestern's law school. And so we're starting to reach out to them and embrace them at that stage. And I'm also at the installations when lawyers are sworn in to become new lawyers, to tell them about these opportunities. The Illinois Supreme Court's mentoring program is out there. And then to be available to them. Because at the end of the day, the Illinois State Bar Association is here for the purpose of serving lawyers and assisting lawyers in the practice of law. And that's just one phase, one aspect of it.
So you're also the face of attorneys in some respect, you know, for Illinois. We're going to talk in a minute on Legal Face-Off about some lawyers who have had some difficulties in the last week or so. We're going to talk about an alderman who was just indicted yesterday. We're going to talk about an attorney who is going to jail for allegedly groping a client. So my question to you is, as the face of 32,000 lawyers here in Illinois, and, you know, knowing that Illinois has been in the news for many of the wrong reasons over the last couple of years, how do you change that? How do you make the perception of your constituency a little better in the eyes of the world?
Well, at the end of the day, I still believe that we are a noble profession, and our image is dictated and determined by us doing well and doing good. And the truth is, we're no different from any other profession, if you will. In fact, as a criminal defense attorney, my clients include doctors and sometimes lawyers, but teachers and engineers. There's no profession that's immune from people who engage in bad conduct. And the legal profession, unfortunately, is not immune either. But all these people that we talk about, I'm reminded that while there is often a rush to judge someone's guilt initially, they still enjoy a presumption of innocence until they're proven guilty. And I have to, as a lawyer, with a lawyer's mindset, give them that benefit of the doubt until they're convicted. That's what never happens, unfortunately. Too often doesn't people don't see it that way.
Last question before we let you go, and it's isba.org. Is that correct?
You are correct.
Last question before we let you go is how do we get NIU Huskies turned around? You know, we came into this season, Vince, as one of the most successful FBS programs in the country, ranking only behind powerhouses like Alabama, Oregon. Kind of an off year this year. I think we won, what, four games? How do we turn the program around and get back in a major bowl next year?
You know what? It's a tough year for me because I'm a Joliet Catholic Hilltopper, and our football powerhouse was down this year as well.
Did they win a game? Did they even win one this year?
Yeah, we got one.
You got one at the end. You were 1-8.
Wow, that's horrific for Catholic High.
The Huskies really, really raised the bar. And you got schools like Western Michigan who followed the roadmap. And there are other schools following the roadmap.
How do we let Fleck go, man? Well, that was tough. That was he should be the coach of the Huskies right now, PJ Fleck.
Well, that's tough, and I don't know enough to weigh in on that, but I hear you.
All right.
That's Vincent F. Cornelius. He's the 140th ISBA president, the Illinois State Bar Association, and the first African American to lead the post. We appreciate your time. Good luck and continued success.
I appreciate the time with you guys. Have a great day.
Thanks, Vince.
Bye-bye.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Make sure to check us out, Facebook, Twitter. We're also on iTunes. You can always subscribe. Make sure to rate, review, and share with a friend. It's Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus with Rich and Jason. As we welcome now Jack Newton, who's the CEO of Clio. Jack, welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Jack. So Clio is a cloud-based practice management tool used by a lot of lawyers. You're the founder of it. We want to talk today about the study that you did. The name of the study was Legal Trends Report, and in it you addressed among the things you addressed was the amount of time that lawyers bill. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I'll give you a bit of background on this study. What we found over the course of the last 8 years is we've grown Clio. We've become this trusted partner to the law firms that use Clio. And they started asking us questions that we didn't really have good answers for. We'd get technical support questions like, you know, I'm a divorce attorney in New Orleans. What should my hourly rate be? And we didn't have a good answer to that. And around a year ago, a light bulb went off where we realized, you know, we've got this enormous volume of data. You know, there's billions of dollars a year that get billed through Clio every single year. And is there an opportunity for us to leverage that data in an aggregated and anonymized way that respects our customers' privacy?
Hey, Jack, I don't want to cut you off. I don't want to cut you off. Sorry, sure. But let's cut to the real gist of what was the most interesting thing. I mean, you've got a great product, we get it, but what was really fascinating is that you discovered that lawyer, and you announced this at your conference in Chicago, that lawyers are only really billing a small portion of available work hours. You know, we all, I bill for my time. Jason's a plaintiff's lawyer, so he doesn't do that. But, you know, obviously the bread and butter of defense attorneys is billing for your time. And, you know, generally you bill 8 hours a day. You know, if you're ethical, some lawyers bill more than
some,
that.
Some bill 25 hours a day.
But what you announced was that lawyers are only billing a small percentage of 8 hours. Take us into that if you can.
Yeah, and it was one of the most surprising findings we discovered in the survey was looking at what's described as the utilization rate, which is the percentage of a lawyer's day that actually gets counted as billable time. Billable work for clients was only 28%. So if you assume an 8-hour workday, which is a pretty conservative estimate for what a typical lawyer's workday looks like, that's only 2.24 hours per day that's actually billed to clients.
And then, which is shocking, kind of right? So let's stop there for a sec. That's pretty shocking. Sure. And I understand not having attended the conference, but reading about it, that was a pretty big bombshell for lots of people in your audience to realize that only a quarter of the day is being captured in billable hours, right?
It was a huge bombshell. And I think what was really interesting about that moment in the conference was a knowing sense across the audience that while this was a bit of a bombshell and the first time it's been talked about at this scale in terms of actual data-driven insights across tens of thousands of lawyers, there was a knowing understanding in the audience that, look, we hate to admit it, but this is true. And in talking with attendees after the keynote where I announced these results, a number of them approached me and said, it's true. We struggle to get more than 2 or 3 hours of billable time generated per day. And it's for a variety of reasons. For a lot of lawyers, unfortunately, it's because they're lacking the clients, the volume of clients and the demand that could help them realize more than 2 or 3 hours per day of billable time. And then on the flip side, I think it also shows and highlights the need for efficiency with lawyers where, the productivity tools, practice management tools, being efficient about billing, even being efficient about how you're acquiring clients, shifting client acquisition online versus spending and burning a lot of time at networking functions, for example, to try to acquire clients. It highlighted a variety of places that lawyers are spending their time, maybe not the most fruitful ways, and certainly not in a profitable way, surviving on 2 hours of billable time per day is something that most.
Jack, let's break some of that. Let's
wouldn't be able to afford.
Yeah, let's break some of that down a little bit if we can. So, what's the number one reason that through your study you discovered that attorneys are not capturing billable hours? What's the biggest reason that you would put on it?
Well, what's interesting is the study didn't dig into that particular factor. What the study did was looked from the bottom up from the billable time that was actually being produced from Clio to look at the amount of time, typical amount of time per day that lawyers were invoicing, and that's where the 2.24 hours per day.
All right, so it's more data driven, but maybe empirically or from talking to folks at the conference, did you get a sense of why if people are working 8-10 hours a day, they're only capturing 2-2.5 hours of billable time? Any sense of what that is? You listed a couple reasons. You said, maybe not enough work, maybe they're not being as efficient. I'll tell you from my perspective as someone who's, billed my time now for 20 years and captured it, a lot of it is, being efficient and making sure that you capture it. A lot of, young attorneys who haven't billed before, frankly, they're just not very good about capturing smaller amounts of time. If they go to a 4-hour deposition, that's one thing, but, you have to capture all of your time, even if it's smaller increments. So, do you see that as one of the reasons?
Absolutely. And I think more than anything, this study is really more of a condemnation of the billable hour model than anything else. And I think we all know the reality is that lawyers are working extremely hard, and there's a lot more of than 2.24 hours of billable time actually being undertaken in any given day. And it's really a death by a thousand cuts kind of scenario for the typical lawyer, I think, where there are just so many small transactional pieces of work that they're doing over the course of the day that might be on the order of 5, 10, 20 minutes, that might be reading an email from a client, replying to a text message from a client, taking a quick call from a client. The kinds of things that you feel bad about billing a client for just accumulate to hours per day and then hundreds of hours per year that just end up coming out of your pocket. And I think that's where this report, if nothing else, really points to value-based billing as maybe being a superior model where you're not suffering from that death by a thousand cuts that I think most lawyers are today.
Jack, as a plaintiff's attorney, it's impossible for me to comprehend how you can only bill 2.2 or 1.4, whatever the total was. When you did this sampling, did you look at large law firms all the way down to solo practitioners for the sampling?
So the sampling was based on Clio's customer base, which is biased to small firms. So we have, really in our customer base, mostly solo small firms and firms of up to, I would say, around 50 attorneys, but not much beyond that. So the study is certainly biased and skewed to the solo to mid-size part of the legal segment.
That's Jack Newton, CEO and founder of Clio, Clio.com, for more information. Thank you so much for your time here. And when you get back to Chicago, make sure you look us up.
I will, absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
And it's time for the last segment before the legal grab bag, Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus with Rich Lenkov and Jason Whiteside. Joining us in the studio, the co-founders of Healing to Action, it's Carla Altmaier and Shireen Alamzadeh. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. A big day for NIU College of Law. We just had ISBA President Vince Cornelius, who's a very prominent alum, and also we've got another alum. So thanks for joining us. Tell us about Healing to Action, what it is, and why you started it.
So Healing to Action is a nonprofit organization that we've just started, and our mission is to build a worker-led movement to end gender violence. And we're doing that through coalition building between anti-violence service providers and the labor rights movement. And we're also training legal, government, and grassroots allies to build capacity to provide sustainable trauma-informed counseling and litigation and advocacy support to workers as they work together to advance their vision for a world free from gender violence.
So, Carla, you graduated from NIU in 2012. How'd you come to work with your partner here?
Well, actually, for 10 years, Shireen and I have represented survivors of gender-based violence, and I started working in Chicago in 2012 as an Equal Justice Works Fellow, and Shireen at that time was a SCADN Fellow here in Chicago who had started in 2011, and we had clients who were survivors that were single mothers, undocumented, and suffering brutal sexual assault on the job, who had free legal free access to legal counsel and rape crisis services, but they never actually came forward because they were really afraid of risk losing their jobs. And there were the other survivors that did decide to come forward, who took a chance on litigation, had severe depression and trauma that resulted and prevented them from working again, keeping them and their families in poverty.
So is it fair to say that most of this is going on, is not being prosecuted or not even being reported because a lot of the women are concerned about their legal status in this country? Is that part of the issue, you think?
Yes, I think that's definitely one piece. You know, there's a lot of different risk factors, and there's a lot at stake for low-wage workers who are experiencing gender violence. So it might be, you know, precarious legal status. It could be long-term unemployment. They just can't afford to lose the job that they have. It could be that they have family members who are tied up in the criminal justice system. And now more than ever, I think there is a really clear cost-benefit analysis that workers have to do before they report violence on the job. And it makes a lot of sense for people to stay quiet and stay underground when they're experiencing violence.
The other thing to add, right, is that the gender-based violence that's happening in these communities is so severe. And I'm talking about women of color in low-wage industries, where two-thirds of that low-wage industry is comprised of women working there. And the rates of gender-based violence are alarming there. For example, you'll see that in restaurant work, 60% of restaurant workers have reported experiencing gender-based violence. In farm work and agricultural work, 80% of women have reported experiencing sexual violence on the job. And it just keeps going, and the numbers are really high. And the rates of reporting are the rates of prosecution are really low by the EEOC. Only 5% of those cases get litigated.
Do you see certain sectors or industries where more of this gender workplace violence occurs?
Yes, specifically in low-wage industries. So when I talk about low-wage industries, I mean restaurant workers, domestic workers, agricultural workers, migrant farm workers who are traveling state to state every season, people who are working in meatpacking plants, warehouses, just everywhere where you would people are earning a, you know, a minimum wage or living paycheck to paycheck, and are in an economically vulnerable position.
And does it coincide too with those industries that have a lot of undocumented workers? I mean, we represent, as a plaintiff's attorney, we represent undocumented workers too. But does it coincide with those industries as well?
Yes, very much so. I mean, obviously, because there is such a difficulty in finding employment for undocumented workers, you will see that they will take the lowest paying jobs, the most contingent labor, jobs that are the least stable, that where people can get replaced very easily. So you see a high rate of undocumented workers. But as I was saying earlier, also other types of vulnerable workers, single mothers, people who maybe have a criminal background, people who have been unemployed for a long time.
I think, you know, in this part of the world, I don't think we're as used to these kind of things. I don't think it gets a lot of attention. I was a little surprised after reading both of your backgrounds that this was as prevalent as it is. So I think it's certainly more prevalent in more developing parts of the world, but do you see it as a growing trend in North America?
Well,
and if so, why do you think that is?
Part of it really is that it has been a growing trend for a really long time. But the issue is that there isn't really a light shining on the issue. And what's great right now is you are starting to hear conversations about sexual assault, sexual harassment in the workplace. You're hearing about it in corporate boardrooms and on college campuses. But the voices of low-wage working women and women of color who are in these jobs are still missing, and they're not part of the national dialogue and need to be. And that's part of what Healing to Action is hoping to do, is really give the tools to women in the communities so that they can become change makers in their communities and have the tools to advocate for policies that are meaningful and responsive to their actual needs.
So the inevitable question, I think, is how do you think this issue is dealt with in the coming 4 years, maybe 8 years under a Trump administration? Certainly a lot of folks feel that Trump will not be very sympathetic to foreigners, to undocumented workers. He certainly talked, you know, very strongly about building a wall and deportation. How do you think your job is going to evolve under a Trump administration?
There's really two issues that we're seeing right now. One will be access to justice and legal services, and the other would be limited protections. Right now, as we've been hearing, the Department of Labor, their overtime regulations are kind of in limbo at this point. Obviously, we'll see increased immigration enforcement. which means that people who are with employers who are taking advantage of them will become easy prey. And we know that the legal aid community is in danger right now in terms of receiving federal funding. So that will limit the options that people have to get free legal services that are needed in those communities.
And I think also, you know, now more than ever, attorneys are needed to actually be in these communities. So, you know, we, even before the Trump administration, you know, we saw that the most vulnerable workers, even when they could connect to attorneys, they needed a community of support around them, telling them that everything was going to be okay, that what they were doing was right, and that it wasn't their fault what had happened to them. And so we need now more than ever attorneys really in these communities, because people have less incentive than ever to come forward and to report crimes, to seek legal services, to seek law enforcement assistance.
And when they experience gender workplace violence, what are the first steps that they're supposed to take in order to report it? Does it have to go through the human resource of the company, or do they go to the outside to, you know, a clinic like yours in order to get that support and file the charges?
Well, in the legal ideally, right, if there was no trauma, what a person would do is document what happened to them. And then they would, depending on who the person was perpetrating the violence, whether it was a coworker or a supervisor, or whether there was a formal structure, because in a lot of times in these employment relationships, there isn't a formal human resources office. But you would want to report, most likely, if it's someone that did this violence that doesn't have hiring or firing power. And after filing that report, regardless of if the employer responds and does give a reasonable response, then that might be the end of the situation. But if the employer does not respond in that in a positive way or addresses the situation, which is what we see most often, then the person will go and file a complaint. But we have to think about what the limitations are of the law. Right now in Illinois, you can file a complaint and you have 300 days from the last act to file a complaint. That's not a lot of time to process trauma when you're talking about violence that is happening to you, and it takes a couple of years to recover from that. So just the systems that are in place are not really responding to what people actually need. And our hope is that through Healing to Action, we can come up with new solutions, develop new policies from the community grassroots, and then try to implement them now.
With the minute or so we've got left, and we'll let you get your website here in a second, why did you choose public interest law as something you wanted to devote your career to? Northern Illinois is certainly one of the foremost schools when it comes to public interest law, but why this as your career path?
Well, for me, Rich, it is a very personal issue. I grew up in a household with a single mom, and just seeing that there was an opportunity for people in the community to work together was something that inspired me, and I also really wanted to give back to my community. And so going to Northern Illinois was the obvious choice. They were so supportive of my public interest career, and the professors have continuously, the school continues to support this work. But I will say, if it wasn't for Northern, I really wouldn't be here, giving me this opportunity to follow my passion in public interest law.
Shireen, same question.
Yep. So I went to law school really to do this work, and I saw a legal education as a tool for implementing social change. So I had been working on gender-based violence issues before I went to law school, and I really see my legal education as just one piece of a larger kind of strategy to try to transform society.
How can we learn more about Healing to Action? Language, website, any of that, social media?
Yes, so we are in the process of launching our website, but right now the best way to follow us is on Facebook at Healing to Action, or you can follow us on Twitter at Healing to Action.
It's Carla Altmaier and Shireen Alamzada, the co-founders of Healing to Action. It's a great cause. Good luck on the journey. Thank you for coming in with us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Legal grab bag time on Legal Face Off with Rich and Jason on WGN Plus. We've got seven topics today. Alderman Willie Cochran from the 20th Ward, which is on the south side of Chicago, he found out in chambers the other day he was charged with 11 counts of wire fraud, 2 counts of extortion, 2 counts of bribery. He's looking at maybe 20 years in the clink.
Yeah, federal grand jury came down yesterday with these charges. You know, another alderman, we just talked last time about Ed Radoliak, who's a former alderman here on the south side of Chicago. This time, Cochran was indicted for a variety of charges by U.S. Attorney Zach Farden here in the Northern District of Illinois. Among the allegations are that he was the sole signatory on a bank account and was using the money in the fund for activities that he shouldn't have. Personal use, $5,000 for his daughter's tuition, for example. Apparently,
that's charity, right?
Yeah.
It constitutes charity.
Allegedly, he withdrew $25,000 from two ATMs near casinos where he gambled. Nothing unusual about
we
that,
say
is that?
Every time on the show, when are they going to learn? And no one ever does.
Yeah, and you know, like one of the biggest things that when I travel or when I talk to people that I'm from Chicago, that you know, they always mention politics and corruption, so it continues to be a black eye in our city and our state.
The jury has begun deliberations in the Dylann Roof trial. Of course, Dylann Roof was the man who confessed to gunning down nine people in a Charleston church.
Yeah, long trial. We talked last Legal Face-Off about the fact that Dylann Roof was representing himself to some extent.
He wisely chose to reverse that and rehire his attorneys.
Right, so closing arguments began this morning on his murder charges. His attorney stood up and, you know, of course, did not dispute the fact that he shot these nine people, but talked about the fact that he didn't understand what he was doing, called him a suicidal loner who never grasped the gravity of what he did. The prosecutor was understandably pretty aggressive in describing him as a killer. He said that this was all resulting from hate and immense racial ignorance when he killed these nine people. So I expect pretty quick verdict by the jury. You know, the only question is...
It only sounds like they're just trying to get the death penalty off the table or get the jury to convict him without the death penalty. But it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of tough with what he did and what he went through.
Yeah, and you know, the videos that were released this week were pretty damaging. You know, he was being interviewed by the police, we saw, and didn't really show any remorse, was laughing a little bit. So, yeah, I expect that the jurors will find him guilty of all charges.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious why he didn't just, if he was doing this as like a suicidal mission, why he didn't just plead guilty and go to prison or the death chamber.
Better call hell because someone's coming to someone's coming to visit.
Grim Reaper is coming for you.
Former New Orleans Saint Will Smith, his killer Cardell Hayes, was he's found guilty of manslaughter, which some feel could get him 60 years. The question that I have initially, why manslaughter and not murder?
Well, they tried to play this element of self-defense, and that's what his whole defense was, is that it was self-defense. There was an argument going on and outside the car, and he thought Will Smith had a gun, so he was, you know, pulled his own gun and shot him, and so that at least would reduce the charge of murder down to manslaughter.
60 years, though, still. I mean, it's either 60 years in jail or you get an injection, right? Which one's worse?
Yeah, and he also, I mean, they tacked on some years for shooting Will Smith's wife, too, because she caught a bullet that went through both of her legs while she was trying to separate the men fighting, so got a few years tacked on for that as well.
Yeah, sentencing is going to occur in February. You know, this is also this verdict is also on the heels of another shooting just a week and a half ago. Yeah. I was actually in New Orleans when this went down, the shooting of Joe McKnight. Similar incident, you know, a road rage incident where Joe McKnight, who's a former NFL player, former New York Jet, was shot after an incident with another vehicle. New Orleans is a dangerous place.
There was another shooting down. I think it was in Thanksgiving too, the Thanksgiving weekend in New Orleans too. Someone died on Bourbon Street. So, yeah, it wasn't. I was just there a couple of months ago too. It didn't seem that violent.
Yeah, that's why I took the train back to the airport and left my rental car just where it was parked.
We can add another place to the list of places that aren't safe to argue about Donald Trump. Inside of an Uber, that's where actor T.J. Miller slapped allegedly an Uber driver after arguing about the president-elect.
I can't wait to hear for when T.J. Miller comes out and he's going to do rehab for 30 days just to try to fall on the sword for slapping an Uber driver.
Yeah, T.J. Miller, star of Office Christmas Party, also of Silicon Valley, was arrested for slapping an Uber driver, as you said, Sam, and this was allegedly over an argument about president-elect Trump. If you look on Miller's pre-election social media, he was pretty aggressive in calling Trump a madman and a lunatic. So we could only assume that the Uber driver was, what, a member of the transition team, maybe? And didn't take kindly to TJ's criticism of the future president. But it just proves my my enduring point. This is why you don't ever talk to the Uber driver.
Yeah,
one of the 27 reasons why you don't talk to the Uber driver.
Just keep your mouth shut.
Exactly.
Take me to the address and be done with it.
Do you tip the Uber driver ever?
Never.
No.
You're not, you know, there's that whole thing about you're not supposed to, although Lyft does have a thing where you can tip them. But
yeah, it's like the scene in Home Alone 2 when the guy's rubbing his fingers. Come on.
Rich and I had a great Lyft ride. It was probably a year ago, leaving a Blackhawks game. It was a lot of carbon monoxide porn in the back. It was wonderful.
Carbon monoxide porn? Or
porine.
Oh, porine. Porine. Oh, that's a different
Get your
story.
Mind out of the gutter, Sam. Any word that begins with P, you assume it's porn.
I'm trying to think, and I won't go any further, what carbon monoxide pornography is.
Yeah.
I'll let you tell me that off the air, Sam.
Speaking of Home Alone, I just watched Home Alone.
Hopefully not three.
Number one.
Yeah.
When you think about Home Alone and all these other like movies that you're exposing your kids to, like there's always a really negative undertone. Like Home Alone, abject child abuse. They left like an 8-year-old home.
Yeah.
Or like you watch like, you know, Big. Like Big is about a kid who's gone. Who's like, you know, and the mom's like, you know, sort of laughing about it. The kid's gone. So
Home Alone in 2016 would be very simple. The kid rolls over, texts his mom, hey, you forgot me.
Yeah, where you at? Yo, where's my breakfast?
Joe Pesci is awesome, though, at Home Alone.
Yeah, he is.
And Daniel Stern, too.
Yeah.
To the NHL, we go into sports now. The Las Vegas Golden Knights name, the trademark denial took place, but the NHL will not reconsider the name. So what's the latest in Vegas?
Yeah, so they're... alleging that, you know, there's many examples of college teams, professional sports teams with coexisting names. The team gave examples of UCLA Bruins and Boston Bruins, Miami Hurricanes in college and Carolina Hurricanes. So they're going to respond and try to overturn this. But, yeah, right now the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has denied the trademark request. So I think it's a good thing. I think it's a terrible name. Like, of all the possible names you could pick, I think the Golden Knights is not great.
The owner is the dealers, the dice,
dealers, the gamblers,
the boulevard, the strip,
yeah,
anything,
flamingos,
loan sharks. You have endless possibilities.
Yeah, they showgirls,
the meth addicts.
Well, they copied Army because Army's the Golden Knights,
right? So yeah, the guy who owns the team is a former Army.
Are they really going to confuse them with a college basketball team in upstate New York?
It's more about the logo more than anything, but
they can't draw the logo differently.
Yeah, they probably will alter it a little bit, but
I'm asking Rich as if he owns the team
who's
involved in this.
Sam, what do you think of the prospects for hockey in Las Vegas and sports teams in general? The Oakland Raiders are going to move there, in probably 2 years?
Yeah, well, that's what Mark Davis wants to do. Here's the thing that I wonder about, because, you know, Blackhawks fans will certainly make that trip, right? I mean, that's a trip for Chicago. They're going to go there maybe once a season. You might even go rally up some friends and all that.
Yeah.
I just wonder how other fan bases travel, because I don't know that Vegas is going to really accept hockey. You're in Vegas not for hockey. You're in Vegas for other reasons.
Yeah, I mean, they have a huge population that, you know, doesn't go to the casinos and stuff. I mean, I don't know where they rank. They got to rank in the top 13 or 14 markets in the country, right, in terms of just population, I bet. So I guess they're banking on the idea that just regular people will go. But
it's all new. I mean, Vegas really hasn't had sports teams until recently, right? So they're...
There's a whole gambling thing that people have always been worried about. That, but I mean, you could gamble on any team anywhere you are.
Yeah, with technology today too. I mean, you can gamble at any point in time. So
yeah,
we've got two more stories here on the legal grab bag. A senior counsel at Fox Rothschild did not want to retire. His name's Murray Schusterman. He passed away at the age of 104. He began practicing law in 1936.
Yeah, this Philadelphia firm. He had joined them in 1969. He also taught law at Temple.
Yeah, what a great backstory, too. The guy came here from the Ukraine when he was a little boy in 1904 with his parents. So, went to law school and became an attorney, obviously, well-respected attorney in Philadelphia. So, I don't know, 104 still practicing law, though?
I'm ready to retire now, and I'm not close to 104.
If this is a current picture of when he passed away, that's pretty good for an attorney
at
104.
For Murray, but if I'm sitting here talking to you guys at 104,
do you think
you have my permission now orally to stick?
Do you think in 60 years we'll still have Legal Face Off?
Yeah.
WGN minus.
Sam walks in.
today on Legal Face Off.
He's like on a respirator.
Bill Cosby back in the news.
Bill Cosby. We've got Gloria Allred on the phone.
We got an alderman committing fraud.
Last story on the grab bag for today. I'm just going to read the four words in front of me. Ohio lawyer hypnotized clients.
I mean, replace the word Ohio with Chicago.
No, let it go. Let it go.
Yeah, I don't know. You want to take this one, Jason? This is one of your...
No, I don't.
This is a 59-year-old woman in Ohio who allegedly visited her lawyer to discuss a custody issue. They chatted. She paid him a $1,500 fee. It was all business as usual. At least she thought it was. When she left, she noticed that her bra was disheveled. Her private area was wet. According, these are literally the words used in the court document.
The article's a little more graphic than the reading of the court. Graphic. It's a little more graphic than.
There was a blank blank spot in her memory. She didn't remember drinking alcohol or taking any meds.
Yeah, and she took a recorder in with her to record the device too. It would record the whole conversation that was going on in the experience too.
Yeah, so. After listening to the tape, the prosecutor's office decided that there was enough to arrest this lawyer, and now he's been sentenced to 12 years in prison. Also classified as a Tier 2 sexual offender, which means he'll have to register as a sex offender. So probably not the best day for the legal profession.
He better hope that he can hypnotize some inmates.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep them off him.
That's a good point. What do you use to... it brings to mind the question, what does a Jason Whiteside use to hypnotize your clients?
Oh, I have the greatest clients. I don't need to hypnotize them.
Is it potion or is it that little spinning wheel?
Yeah.
It's just a clock in my office that ticks.
You're getting very sleepy. You have got a good case.
Holiday party
Sign
tomorrow?
Here.
You guys going to be there?
Oh, where, yeah. For WGN?
Ugly sweater party?
Are we invited to the big party, or are we going to sit in the closet with the other podcasts? It's a special party for the podcasters.
No, yeah, sorry.
Over
you're
at
not,
McDonald's on State Street?
Yeah. You're not in the main party room. You're in the closet.
One of these days we'll make it. Yeah, we'll be there. We hope to see Sam and the rest of the crew getting crazy 10 o'clock in the morning on a Friday.
Yeah, I can't wait for those mimosas. That's going to be fantastic, Sam.
For Rich, for Jason, my name is Sam. For anything you may have missed, Facebook and Twitter, you can check us out at WGNplus.com for past shows. We will talk to you, I believe, in the new year, because I think we're going to cancel this next show.
We got one more.
On the 23rd of December.
Santa's coming to take away the 22nd. It's gone. Bye-bye, show.
It's a Christmas miracle.
Whenever it is. We'll see you then.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.